This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Catherine Fritke, and these are the stories you don't want to miss. For the week of January 30th, here are some top stories. An ongoing civil rights lawsuit against the county is costing taxpayers hundreds of thousands of dollars every month. As KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins reports, the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office is paying to comply with a court order and footing the bill for an outside group to monitor their progress.
For fiscal year 2017, the county budgeted $20 million for the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office to comply with the rulings in a racial profiling lawsuit. The county set aside an additional $6.3 million to pay for the cost of the court-appointed monitor. Receipts provided to KJZZ show the county is paying on average $250,000 each month to the monitoring group Warshaw & Associates for services that include court consultations, site reviews, and investigative oversight. Maricopa County Sheriff Paul Pinzone says he's established a good relationship with the monitor, but is wary of the way his department is being evaluated.
There's an element of subjectivity as it relates to the term compliance. So we need to make sure that there's complete clarity in our conversations and the language that we're using.
Pinzone has given no timeline as to when he thinks the department will be in full compliance. Jimmy Jenkins, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
For many in the U.S., a good Super Bowl party comes with a tasty Super Bowl of guacamole. But its main ingredient, the avocado, is at the center of a trade dispute between the U.S. and Mexico that recently caused tons of the creamy fruit to be turned back at the border. From KJZZ's Mexico City Bureau, Rodrigo Cervantes reports.
If you've watched the Super Bowl on TV in the past few years, you're probably familiar with ads like this one.
Dave has a problem. He misses touchdowns because he loves hammering back guacamole 24/7.
Avocados from Mexico.
Avocados from Mexico is the brand used to commercialize the imports. They're incredibly popular in the U.S., where 8 out of 10 avocados sold are Mexican. In fact, the U.S. is the largest importer of Mexico's avocados, and Arizona is among the top consumers.
Consumption in the Super Bowl is very high. It's about between 10 and 12% of the total consumption of the year.
So that's Ramon Paz, advisor of the Association of Producers and Exporters of Avocados from Mexico, an organization that also operates the Avocados from Mexico brand that you hear on those TV jingles. According to Mexican authorities, Mexico exported more than 700,000 tons of avocado to the U.S. in most of last year. The demand grows steadily, according to Paz. Avocados are grown throughout Mexico, but only one of the country's 32 states has an agreement to sell them to the U.S.
Michoacán.
Lino Anastasio is a cook in a small restaurant in Mexico City. He uses avocados from the state of Michoacán to prepare guacamole every day. In fact, 80% of the Mexican avocado comes from Michoacán. No wonder that Lino's kitchen, as well as the majority of restaurants in Mexico, use avocados from that state. Lino has heard rumors that Mexican avocados won't be allowed in the U.S. territory anymore under the new administration. That's because in late January, something close to that happened. A shipment from the state of Jalisco was stopped at the U.S. border in Texas. The U.S. Department of Agriculture attributed the shipment rejection to paperwork both countries had failed to sign. But Paz, the avocado lobbyist, was skeptical. He noted that the U.S.'s rejection came just as Mexico turned down a deal to import potatoes from the U.S.
The USDA decided to link the expansion of the avocado market of Mexico for Jalisco and other states with access of American potatoes to Mexico.
The USDA declined the accusations, arguing that the negotiation has nothing to do with any other commodity. Mexico only said that the avocado halt was a U.S. decision. Jalisco already exports to other countries. However, both agriculture agencies say they are working together to bring a solution. And meanwhile, the Jalisco avocados will have to wait. And for this weekend, Paz wants to assure American consumers there will be plenty of avocados from Mexico.
We expect all the fans of Patriots or Falcons to enjoy their guacamole and enjoy the Sunday.
Rodrigo Cervantes, KJZZ News, Mexico City.
You're listening to the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Now, let's hear a conversation from KJZZ's original production, The Show.
The Supreme Court case Roe v. Wade is one of the most controversial the justices have ever considered. And since the 1973 decision, it's been a lightning rod, one that's caused emotional and political reactions on a regular basis. But what did the High Court's decision actually do? And could Roe survive a more conservative court? With me to talk about that is Harvard Law Professor Glenn Cohen, an expert in reproductive technology, among other things. So, Professor, let's go back to 1973. Justice Harry Blackmun was criticized for making the case more about the right to privacy. What were the other relevant issues around the decision?
This was a huge change in the law. We had many restrictive abortion laws across the country at that time. And really, by the time it made it to the U.S. Supreme Court, Blackmun famously found a right to privacy in the penumbra, that's the word he used, of several amendments to the Constitution. And while this wasn't completely unprecedented, it was preceded by a case called Griswold v. Connecticut a few years earlier relating to contraception and the right to contraception. I think most people would say this was a dramatic kind of constitutional swerve or change, and it was somewhat unexpected from Blackmun. In reality, what we think of now as one of the big dividers between the Democratic and Republican Party, pro-life versus pro-choice, this is really a post-Roe development. Roe, in some ways, set the battlefield for this kind of polarization.
Is there something about reproduction, is there something about abortion that makes this, and the emotion attached to it, that makes it so this is the type of case that even though it is more than 40 years old, that will still spark that energy and that emotion from a legal standpoint where it will continue to be challenged unless in some ways it is at some point overtaken?
So it's a great, great question. Let me answer it in a few ways. The first is just to say that some people would say that Roe v. Wade, the reason why it keeps coming up again and again is because the court entered the fray too soon. So this is often referred to as kind of the backlash theory. And the idea is the court can be a little bit in front of the people, but if the court gets too far in front of the people in terms of its decision making, it creates points of contention and actually buffs off an opposition. So some people would say that's why Roe comes back many times. A different take, and I think probably closer to my take, is probably or maybe two takes that are a little closer to my take. One is that electoral politics in the United States have found it convenient to use Roe v. Wade as a dividing point, and in particular, both on the left and on the right, that basically the two parties have ossified on their positions on this. You cannot be a presidential candidate for the Republican Party if you want to leave Roe v. Wade in place and you want to retain the right to abortion. You cannot be a presidential candidate who's successful in the Democratic Party if you wanted to reverse Roe v. Wade. So the result has been that both parties use this issue to turn out their base, and it's kind of a dividing line and identification point. It's hard to see us moving from that. And then maybe the third reason, which is probably the closest to my own take, is the following. As a moral matter, abortion is actually a very, very hard issue. We have strong intuitions that it would be wrong to kill a child after it's born without a very good reason. And many people have great intellectual difficulty saying, well, how can I square that intuition with a view on abortion? Here, I think, you know, those like me who do support the abortion right, but think it's a hard and difficult issue, would say, well, it's clear that fetuses are persons, or I would grant that a fetus is a person, or even if I think a fetus is a person, I still think that a woman's right to control her body overcomes that fact. But I think very few people will kind of have that conversation in an adult sort of way. It's much easier just to say, I am solidly pro-life or I am solidly pro-choice and leave it at that, rather to engage in the questions.
Well, so if Judge Gorsuch becomes Justice Gorsuch and succeeds Justice Scalia, is this an issue that those who are on the pro-life side or the pro-choice side might anticipate the court at some point in the near future would try to find a case that could at least chip away more at Roe?
I think the answer is absolutely. And as you say, just to focus on that word, chip away, the strategy for the most part on people who've wanted to restrict abortion, let's just say the right in this case, has been chipping away slowly at the edges till we get to the core, right? So it's been through, for example, what are known as targeted restrictions of abortion providers. That's what the people on the left call it. They call them trap laws. Justice Ginsburg actually used that phrase, I think, to the ire of many people on the right in one of her opinions recently. And essentially, these are things like saying, how big are the corridors of your hospital? Do you have an auxiliary facility in this distance? Are you able to do this here? That's one strategy, that by passing laws that make basically the facilities that do abortions to be more onerous on them, and therefore you can push many of them out of existence. The other have been some laws passed relating to fetal pain, right, claiming that fetuses feel pain at 20 weeks, which is before the viability stage, and therefore it's okay to criminalize abortion at that period. Now, Judge Gorsuch actually hasn't ruled on any of these cases, as far as I know from his Tenth Circuit jurisprudence. But in one area of law that's allied, which is the access to contraception, the contraception mandate in the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, he has basically decided with the conservatives and also given a lot more space for religious objection. So the anticipation is that he would likely be around where Justice Scalia was or where the other conservatives of the court are on questions about abortion. But maybe he'll surprise us. Sometimes Supreme Court justices do.
Glenn Cohen is a law professor at Harvard. We've been discussing Roe v. Wade, its origins, and staying power.
In business news, a Tempe company that helps people find jobs is hiring so fast, it needs a new office. From KJZZ's business desk, Christina Estes reports on ZipRecruiter's surging growth.
Thank you so much, guys.
ZipRecruiter CEO Ian Siegel toasts employees as they celebrate their 27,000 square foot space at Hayden Ferry Lakeside. The online jobs platform company picked Tempe last year to open its first office outside of its California-based headquarters.
We started with 30 employees, and that office had the ability to scale to about 120. And we had thought that it would be a year and a half or more before we filled that office, but we filled it in 6 months.
Siegel says 220 employees work in the current space, which can expand to accommodate about 400. ZipRecruiter allows an employer to post a job opening to hundreds of different employment sites with a single submission. For job seekers, the platform searches hundreds of sites to find listings that best fit their qualifications. Christina Estes, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
For 10 years, KFest has celebrated the flora, fauna, and subterranean features of Southern Arizona's Karchner Caverns State Park. But the event also underlines the surprising amount of scientific research that supports the cave, and vice versa. From the Arizona Science Desk, KJZZ's Nicholas Gerbus reports.
Once upon a time, there was a slime.
Some real astute observers in the cave unit several years ago observed something growing on some fiberglass.
That's Karchner Cave Unit Ranger Heidi Lockstead. The fiberglass, painted and molded to look like rock, hides gear like wires and pipes. It keeps the caves looking natural, but there was nothing natural about this ooze.
We don't know what it is, so why don't we contact the University of Arizona Microbiology Department?
Enter Julie Nelson and Louisa Eichner, who linked the goo to paint-eating microbes. As Nelson explained, when your nutrient options amount to bat guano or the thin gruel of desert drip water, you take whatever carbon you can get.
Microbes are amazingly resourceful. They will figure out a way to live anywhere on this planet, and probably anywhere on any planet.
Their research joined a steady drip of science that has echoed through these limestone caverns almost since their discovery. When co-discoverers Gary Tennant and Randy Tufts could no longer shield the caves through secrecy, they sought out science to help protect them post-development. The cave's first environmental monitoring stations were theirs.
We have taken over that data set and still use the same monitoring stations, the old PVC stands with the old cookie sheets and all that.
As for Nelson and her colleagues, they soon spotted another disruptive food source. Tourists.
We are constantly shedding skin cells, hair cells, and lint off our clothing. And we were able to see that the microbes that grow near along the trail tend to be microbes that can take advantage of those kind of ready supplies of carbon.
In response, the park installed misters to help visitors contain themselves as they enter the cavern. They're but one of several research-inspired safeguards, including the airlock doors that keep the cave's humidity near 99%. Beyond microbes and fungi, experts have found a growing number of cave-adapted insects in this humid grotto. 98, according to U of A research associate Bob Pape. Wendy Moore, curator of the U of A Insect Collection, which houses Pape's finds, said 16 of them are new to science.
They have found a refuge there in the cave, and so there's many that live there and only there.
Karchner conducts its own research as well, including drip studies and keeping count of the cave myotis bats that famously use Karchner's big room as a summer maternity roost.
We are in the sinkhole, and we have counters, and we sit in a lawn chair, and as they come out, we use clickers.
Such counts paint only a partial picture, however, so Joel Diamond, a bat expert at Arizona Game and Fish Department, added acoustic sensors, which detect bats' echolocation calls. He also helps staff and volunteers analyze data.
But it's really just support. You know, they're doing all the real work. We're just coming in and helping them make sense of the numbers.
Science is essential to stewardship, but parks help scientists too. They provide distributed managed spaces for monitoring groundwater, preserving dark skies, or providing habitat for migrating monarch butterflies. All activities currently underway at Karchner. Today, according to Arizona State Parks Research and Science Manager Bob Cassavant, state parks support 80 to 100 research projects statewide. Many rely on volunteers. Carrying on such work under post-recession cutbacks that seem likely to continue sounds daunting. But in a limestone cathedral carved out and built up by water a century per inch, nothing feels impossible for long. Nicholas Gerbis, KJZZ News, Karchner Caverns.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by Vitalist Health Foundation, the Arizona Community Foundation, the ASU Biodesign Institute, Alliance Bank of Arizona, Beach Fleischmann, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Catherine Fritke, and this is KJZZ, your news and information source.